exploiting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. Cause they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodity.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome back Shahid Buttar, attorney, human and civil rights activist, also hot off another campaign against House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. We'll catch up with him about that experience and how he was working to push the Democratic Party agenda to the left. After that, we welcome back to the show Dan Kovalik. His latest book, Cancel This Book, The Progressive Case Against Cancel Culture. Stay tuned.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies like an ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we welcome back to the show Shahid Buttar. He's the first Democrat to ever challenge House Speaker Nancy Pelosi in a general election, winning 80,000 votes in November of 2020. And helped force the House and Democratic Party leadership into half a dozen policy concessions. Shahid's a constitutional lawyer, musical artist, community organizer, and policy advocate. He graduated from Stanford Law School in 2003. He's worked for nonprofits including the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Muslim Advocates, and the American Constitution Society for Law and Policy. Shahid Buttar, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having me, Mickey. It's always good to be with you.
You are always on the front line somewhere working for social justice. And today for our conversation, we're going to look at political concerns from the Trump to Biden administration. And as you and I were talking a few moments ago before we got on air, the more things change, well, the more maybe they stay the same. And we wanted to talk with you about some of your experiences running against Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House. And we wanted to talk to you about some of the issues that you are very passionate about and expert in, including immigration, voting rights, issues of racial tensions in the U.S. So, Shahid, welcome to the Project Censored Show, and let's just kick things off here. Based on your experiences running from the last election, of course, we know that you didn't defeat Nancy Pelosi, but the fact that you have made such significant inroads against such an institutionalized character is more than impressive.
I appreciate that. I do see there being a moment of profound reckoning in the American body politic. And it's not just institutional. It's from the grassroots, from the outside, all the way to the inside the halls of Congress. And I think about last year in the streets when millions of us, in the midst of a pandemic, took to the streets to defend the lives and rights of our neighbors. I'm particularly reflective of that moment for a couple of different reasons. One is that in the time since then, the House shifted and moved the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act forward into the Senate. Now, it hasn't become law yet, and we know what's happening in the Senate, and that's a whole other conversation. But just to force Nancy Pelosi to show up for a set of profound civil rights reforms that she had opposed for the better part of two decades, I am so grateful to all of our supporters to have made that change possible. And that was the grassroots forcing the establishment to heed our voices. And just to be clear, I'm critical of parts of that bill, and it's particularly ironic or poignant to be thinking about it now as we're taping this program. The trial of Derek Chauvin, the murderer of George Floyd, is underway, and the need for policing to be subjected to constitutional limits. It was one of the things that long animated my activism before running for Congress. It was one of the things that animated our campaign, and I'm really excited to see those concerns having spread well beyond our campaign. You know, it's across the body politic. There is this reckoning happening. And I do hope to see the rhetoric of our Constitution, the promise of our country, the idea that one is supposed to be safe unless you've done something wrong, innocence until proven guilty. Those are principles that we have to respect and protect. I think the trial of George Floyd's murderer presents that opportunity, as does the reforms in Congress.
Just to remind our listeners who will be hearing this show, it's late March when you and I are talking. The show will be airing early April. As Andy Lee Roth and I often joke at Project Censored, the world doesn't stop for us to take its temperature. Things will likely change by the time folks hear our conversation. But This reminds me, we're talking about grassroots change. You're talking about a significant challenge to a deeply entrenched, established Democrat in San Francisco, allegedly liberal, stereotypical San Francisco, right? But there's a lot of things that seem to go along with Pelosi that actually seem more illiberal or are certainly not left-leaning or progressive in many ways. And I think your candidacy and your campaign really punctuated that in a lot of ways. What exactly do you think stood out about this candidacy? For a lot of people, you know, Nancy Pelosi is the poster child for left-wing politics and liberalism in San Francisco.
I think what you're to some extent reflecting on is the establishment pattern of relying on corporate media to present false depictions of issues. And Nancy Pelosi is a poster child of corporate media contriving a veneer, a caricature, let's say, of a corporate politician who for 30 years has been supporting Wall Street while holding and occupying the seat representing the United States' most progressive city. I take particular umbrage to this along a couple different dimensions. One of them, San Francisco is the city where the United Nations was founded. It's a city that is proudly committed to international peace and justice and to human rights. And our very powerful voice in Congress is part of the still now ongoing, two decades later, cover-up over CIA torture of detainees in Bush's war on terror. Every day that we don't prosecute the figures at the CIA who were involved, we are continuing to violate international law. And just to be clear about how bad this is, because Nancy Pelosi helped cover up continuing abuses of international law, the heads of the CIA torture program now lead the agency. And that is her legacy. She also has this legacy beyond torture of enabling every war for plunder over the last 30 years. And I am a child of the military-industrial complex. The reason I am Pakistani-American in particular is because U.S. foreign policy a generation ago supported a military dictator in my native country, and that dictatorship denied civil liberties, including religious freedom. That's why I'm an American. I would not be American if the Pentagon did not run around the world abusing civil liberties and civil rights. And I now am a resident of a city that I love, a city that is proudly committed to human rights and peace and justice, and we see this subversion of our voice. Another area where I see this really closely demonstrated is climate justice. It's long been a sensibility that has united the city. We're proudly committed to not only defending the future, but especially in the wake of the wildfires. You know this all too well, being up in Northern California. Last September, we woke up in San Francisco and had a day when the skies remained blood red at high noon, and our powerful voice in Congress derides the Green New Deal as a, quote, Green New Dream, or whatever they call it. That's how Nancy Pelosi addresses climate justice. Here, I'm going to complicate the picture because at the same time that San Francisco is united behind peace and justice, we are a city that has one of the worst examples of environmental racism in the entire country, an entire neighborhood. The last black neighborhoods of San Francisco were poisoned by the Navy for decades, radiation poisoning at the Hunters Point shipyard. And Nancy Pelosi in particular helped engineer a land privatization deal that has now led to tens of thousands of units being built on unsafe land. These are legacies that need to be grappled with and addressed. And the last thing I'll say here is that, you know, I watched not only the corporate media contrive this caricature of a career incumbent who happens to be, you know, one of the wealthiest members of Congress, but she hasn't debated anyone since 1987. And if voters had a chance to hear the contrast between the alternatives that were presented to our city last year that I hope will be presented again, I would be in Congress already. And I'm looking forward to the press showing up for work by highlighting the issues. And that was a thing that in 2020 really didn't happen. And so, you know, I reflect on the 2020 race as a remarkable success in having extracted these policy concessions from the speaker on policing, on funding the post office, on challenging the president's unilateralism in war, other issues as well, including executive accountability. But I also am eager to see our electoral process demonstrate its own legitimacy. And the key to that, frankly, is discussion of the issues. And that's one thing that was really sorely lacking, particularly when incumbents refuse debate.
It's political theater, as you've described it, and the way the corporate media contrives these alleged rivals and these supposedly very different looking candidates. In California, the Republican Party is, you know, in places like San Francisco, it's actually like a third party. And what suffers as a result is like what you just said. There is no real debate. Everything is kind of just taken for granted by Democrats. another California politician that screams to the forefront when you were talking is, of course, Dianne Feinstein, whose husband, Richard Blum, had a big hand in screwing the post office in various ways, selling off properties. She, of course, was, quote unquote, investigating the CIA when they were hacking into her computers and the committee that was investigating them. And then mysteriously, she doesn't find any major wrongdoing in the torture probe.
The only time I've ever seen Senator Feinstein show up for work was in that context. In the fall of 2013, she decried a constitutional crisis over the CIA hacking the Senate and threatening her staff. And so she did actually push back against torture, but everything else, she has been a complete rubber stamp.
She was investigating it, but the outcome of it, it really fell flat. And I can't help but suspect that that was partly by design. That's how those commissions work. Mistakes were made. Obama said, we tortured some folks. We're moving forward. Don't look back. This is what you have been working to change for the better part of the last two decades. Political change in the United States takes a generation, maybe more, several generations. Was the expectation that you were going to come in and unseat one of the most powerful politicians in the U.S.?
I had the most lopsided fight in U.S. politics. And I confronted somebody who is the third wealthiest member of Congress. She served for 30 years. We had a 15-to-1 fundraising disadvantage, and her name is viral in every news cycle. And she refuses to debate, and no reporters ever ask her hard questions. So you have an entire party's establishment propping up this figure. On the one hand, if we thought about the political arena as simply Republicans versus Democrats and bad guys and good guys, maybe that would be okay. And many people do have so simplistic an analysis. But you and I both know that any blue will not necessarily do, because it is precisely the set of issues where Democrats support Republican policies that force our communities into the streets. That's why we all took to the streets to say we have to end qualified immunity, as I proposed to do in 2018, before the murder of George Floyd, before qualified immunity became a widely understood issue. I proposed that it should be ended. That was just taken directly from the demands of the movement that I've been a part of since even before the Ferguson uprising. And you were talking about the time it takes to create change. A big part of that is the limits of career politicians and their willingness to stand with communities. And so it takes communities' growing voices to replace those figures. And I represent a voice from the Occupy movement, the anti-war movement, the immigrant rights movement, the movement for Black Lives, challenging the corporate center that continues to marginalize voices that would favor civil rights, peace and justice, climate justice. So there is a transpartisan awareness across the United States that our predatory corporate policies, if it's not stopped, are going to drive our species off a cliff. And I think it is long overdue, this challenge to the corporate center. I'm excited to be a part of it. I'm proud to have been the first Democrat to face Pelosi. And I'm particularly just grateful to all of the voices from Washington to San Francisco, and particularly voices not in the institutions, but in the grassroots that are doing all of the different things that people do to force these issues into the public debate. Because the longer we've waited for Washington to show up, the more convinced I think many of us have grown that we need a change.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, speaking with Shahid Batar right now. He is a constitutional lawyer, musical artist, community organizer, and policy advocate. Ran against Nancy Pelosi in the last election cycle, winning 80,000 votes. We're talking to Shahid about a variety of political issues. And after this brief musical break, we're going to talk specifically about immigration, policing, voting rights, and of course, issues surrounding race. Stay tuned.
You
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of today's show, we are honored to welcome back Shahid Buttar. He is the first Democrat to ever challenge House Speaker Nancy Pelosi in a general election. In the last cycle, won 80,000 votes and helped force the House and Democratic Party leadership into half a dozen policy concessions. No small feat. Shahid's also a constitutional lawyer, has worked with many nonprofits, and we are now speaking about the aftermath of Trump to Biden. Some things have changed, but also a lot of things, of course, are staying the same, and some of those things aren't for the better. Let's go down a list of a few things that you certainly addressed in your campaign. Let's start with immigration. Biden has continued many of Trump's policies.
International law entitles asylum seekers to a legal process. They're allowed to enter a country and then seek legal asylum. And the detention of migrants en masse along the southern border is more or less flatly illegal. I do want to acknowledge progress where it's due. You know, the one area I'd say here where we've made improvements is the Biden administration has allowed unaccompanied children into the U.S. where the Trump administration was turning them away. And that is progress. And just to note the continuing unfortunate disappointments in the Democratic establishment to house those migrant children, putting them in DHS, Homeland Security, and possibly DOD, Defense Department facilities, instead of Health and Human Services facilities. In the Health and Human Services facilities, people are able to socially distance. They're able to stay safe. That is the middle of a pandemic right now. And when you see the very limited footage that's become available from the DHS and DOD facilities, there's no social distancing. There's not even a minimal provision of basic human rights. We're talking about compounding violations of international human rights with further violations of other international human rights. And that's not something that any of us should be proud of. America voted for change, and the issues at the border, it's not just the continuation of the policy. It's the continuation of a long preceding pattern that was bipartisan before. Many of Trump's defenders made the point, and unfortunately, in this very limited instance, they were right, that parts of the immigration deportation scheme that he was promoting were laid by the previous administration, by the Obama administration, which inherited the Bush administration's framework. And the bipartisan continuity of the anti-immigrant policies that to this point have denied any pathway to citizenship, have split up families, including U.S. citizen children across the United States, created humanitarian disasters within the United States, crashed local economies. This is a pattern that has continued entirely too long. And the point here that I think gets overlooked is that what happens to we immigrants never is limited to we immigrants. We are the canaries in a constitutional coal mine. And the abuses that get normalized by picking on vulnerable communities and people like us, they ultimately and inevitably expand to include others. One example of that is the biometric surveillance scheme that the FBI has created on the backs of immigrants, which has now included hundreds of millions of records. And they're not limited to immigrants. All Americans are now being biometrically tracked by the FBI without any legal mandate. And the way that they built that program was by presenting it to the public as an immigration deportation initiative. And that's exactly the kind of chicanery that we can expect.
Biometrics, the whole evisceration of civil liberties, tracking. Let's use that as a segue into policing. You mentioned qualified immunity before. What's going on right now? Do you see any kind of shift out of the Trump administration into the Biden administration? Is there a different culture emerging at all?
I see it happening being compelled by local prosecutors who are transforming the local dimensions of the prison industrial policing complex. People like Chase Aboudin in San Francisco, George Gascon in Los Angeles, Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, Wesley Bell in St. Louis, there are others. I see them as the bright spots here. Congress has, at least in recent years, shown up. The House passing the Justice and Policing Act was a big deal. And there are parts of that act that I've advocated for 20 years. I want to particularly draw one of them. The data collection provisions of the Justice and Policing Act would be a huge step forward because they would allow us finally to empirically establish how bad is the profiling in this neighborhood or that neighborhood. At the moment, the police don't track data about the racial impacts of stops or arrests or uses of force. And so the Justice and Policing Act would require that. That was the essential nugget of the End Racial Profiling Act, which Congress has never enacted. I've been advocating for that for almost 20 years. And so I'm glad to see the data provisions, for instance, finally adopted. And there are other parts of the Justice and Policing Act, for instance, with respect to qualified immunity, that would be big steps forward. But I need also to pause and push back on pieces of it, because the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, this is the bill that Nancy Pelosi donned kente cloth and knelt in Congress to introduce and then forgot George Floyd's name at the press conference. This is a bill that would expand police budgets and expand police surveillance at a time when millions of Americans have been clamoring in the streets to reinvest in our communities and rationalize spending by taking it away from police departments and giving it to social workers. And that's exactly what this bill does not even begin to do. It's so frankly offensive for calls for justice to be met with proposals to expand the budgets of the agencies responsible for these sustained continuing human rights abuses. It is absolutely preposterous to me that anybody can get away with a straight face in the United States today claiming that police protect and serve anything other than capital, because they don't protect and serve people or communities. You know, I'm particularly conscious of the fact that there is a trial underway right now about a police officer who tortured someone in public for almost 10 minutes to death on camera. And it's a year later, and we're now having a debate as to whether or not that's legally impermissible. If anything, people who have badges should be held to higher standards of care with respect to the people who they all too often murder. And we apply very permissive rules to police that effectively encourage state violence. And the law should be, it could be, it will be much more humane than that.
Chai Bitar, speaking of race and policing, it's as if we jumped into a time machine in Georgia on voting rights recently. Jim Crow isn't just in cyberspace. Jim Crow is basically back sitting on the front porch in Georgia right now. What we're seeing in terms of these developments here. And Georgia, of course, obviously anybody paying attention to the last election knows Georgia played a very interesting historic role in the outcome of this election. What can you say about what's happening in Georgia?
A faith leader in Georgia described the Republican state legislators who put in place the recently enacted restrictions on voting rights there as the Klan in a three-piece suit. It's a terrifying reflection, but it fits all too well. The provisions passed there include not only new voting ID requirements to constrain absentee voters, but the most revealing aspect of it was a provision that criminalizes the provision of water or food to people who are standing in line waiting to vote. And just think about the last several voting cycles where secretaries of state and local election administrators misallocate voting machines. They end up forcing people in urban areas, who, usually minority voters who tend to vote Democratic, forcing them to stand in lines for hours. And now it's criminalized to serve people food and water. I'm a Muslim, so I'm saying this is a bit out of my lane, but I just find the hypocrisy very intense among people who will proudly champion a political version of Christianity that doesn't allow the human charity of giving your neighbors water. It is so profoundly cynical, this law. And this is not recent. It's not new. Attacks on voting rights are as old as the Republic. And equally as old as the Republic are efforts to defend and expand the franchise to ensure that more people can participate. There was a Supreme Court case about 8 years ago, Shelby County versus Harper, that opened the floodgate for these kinds of right-wing laws in the states by striking down the enforcement provisions of the Voting Rights Act. It's almost been a full decade since then. And the Republican onslaught undermining voting rights, this is just the latest step in a long-going pattern. I want to briefly, though, take this back to the civil rights era. A lot of people, not on the left, but like the center left, Democrats, let's say, they'll remember the civil rights era as a triumphant moment in American history, and they'll reduce it to an amusement park ride. And, you know, we won that, we can celebrate it, now we move on. The civil rights movement was denied almost every one of its central goals. We were denied a right to food, denied a fundamental right to education, denied public housing, denied employment equality opportunities. The two things that the civil rights movement got were anti-discrimination provisions, which have withered in years since, and school integration, and integration across a lot of other arenas, which has basically then been weaponized into tokenism. The integration ended up becoming Clarence Thomas. We can do a lot better than that. We should be meaningfully committed to racial opportunity, to racial equality, to undermining systemic bias. And particularly, I mean, I describe racism as the institutional use of marginalization to perpetuate it. We have to break those systems. That's what government is for. That's what law is for. And the movement that I'm a part of and come from and hope to represent in Washington, if I'm so lucky at some point, we are here to liberate people from government and from corporations. And when we look particularly at this voting rights restrictions over time. Mm-hmm. They're like the one ring to rule them all, because when you deny people the opportunity to vote or to meaningfully participate in the political process through other means, like denying third parties ballot access or not debating your opponents, that sort of restrictions on democracy, it's path dependent. It creates other than violations. You know, one reason why the CIA has gotten away with decades of torturing people is because we don't have free and fair elections to put in place advocates who would actually defend the human rights norms that we once fought a world war to establish.
I couldn't help but think when we were talking about what's going on in places like Georgia, going back to January 6th, where we saw an overwhelming mob of white males storming the Capitol, banging through windows and kicking the door down. A Georgia state legislature was just arrested for knocking on a door. A woman of color, a legislator.
Doing her job to protect her constituents from being railroaded and taken advantage of by her careerist colleagues. She was arrested, dragged out in handcuffs. When at the same time, you know, and when I think about the Capitol insurrection, it wasn't just the fact that all these people were allowed to storm the Capitol. They were allowed to storm the Capitol, even though we all squander $750 billion every year on so-called defense. For what? Where was the defense? Where was the security establishment when we needed it?
You know, Shahid, you've been a candidate in the past, and of course, 2022. We'll be here before we know it, but I wanted to give this opportunity for you a couple minutes, say some things that you might want to say to our listeners. And of course, where can people follow what you're doing and find out more about your important work?
Thank you, Mickey. I see us on the cusp of a bright new future or a very dark one, one that is either very hostile to human life on this planet or one that can encourage us to stand together in the face of our shared challenges, both across our country and across the world. And that's the movement I represent. Folks who want to learn more about the opportunity to win a new voice for San Francisco and our efforts in 2020 when we were running then, can check us out at shahidforchange.us. I haven't yet declared my plans for 2022. I am exploring the possibility of continuing the campaign to finish the job, to liberate my city's voice in Congress and defend the future from corporate capital. So whether at our website or on any of the social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, you can find us online at Shahid for Change.
Shahid Buttar, thank you so much for joining us today on the Project Censored Show and talking about all of the things that you've been working on for so long. And of course, listeners can follow more of what Shahid has coming up in the next year or so at Shahid for Change. So again, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll certainly be catching up with you later in the year for really important updates, because a lot of the things that we're talking about right now are going to be developing over the next couple of months, and it'd be great to have you back for some more updates.
Always happy to do it. Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Up next on the Project Censored Show, we welcome back author Dan Kovalik. We're going to be speaking about a brand new book out very soon, Cancel This Book, The Progressive Case Against Cancel Culture. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we are honored to welcome back Dan Kovalik. He is author of numerous books and most recently forthcoming, Cancel This Book, The Progressive Case Against Cancel Culture, out on Hot Books. Dan Kovalik is the author of the critically acclaimed The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, The Plot to Attack Iran, The Plot to Control the World, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, and No More War. He's been a labor and human rights lawyer since graduating from Columbia Law School in 1993. He has also represented plaintiffs in cases arising out of egregious human rights abuses in Colombia, has written extensively for HuffPost and Counterpunch, and has lectured throughout the world. Dan Kovalik, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Mickey, I'm so glad to be back. Thank you.
Dan, it's always so good to catch up with you. You are amazingly prolific, coming out sometimes with a couple books a year in the last few years. And of course, there's an unfortunate pattern and theme in some of the series of books you've done over at Hot Book Skyhorse, The Plot 2. And so right you have been in all of your theses and the books that you've had come out just in the last few years. And now you're really ahead of a curve on much, much needed analysis over what's been deemed cancel culture. Your latest book out in April is called Cancel This Book, The Progressive Case Against Cancel Culture. And of course, I couldn't help but think of Abby Hoffman and Steal This Book, some of the countercultural riffing that you have going on here. And Dan, you have a stellar argument that you're putting forward for free speech and open discourse and dialogue in your book, and I hope it's read far and wide. What led you to getting into this particular topic at this time?
It's a great question, because as you say, it really is a departure from what I've written about in the past, which is about U.S. foreign policy from a peace activist perspective, an anti-war perspective, which is the segue into how I wrote this book. I'd been concerned about this phenomenon for a while, but it really came to a head for me last spring in May of 2020, when a dear friend of mine and colleague, Molly Rush, a longtime peace activist, was canceled here in Pittsburgh. And I'll give you a little background, because I think it's a very emblematic case. If you never heard of Molly Rush, she was one of the original Plowshare 8. So decades ago, she had a family, she had a husband and kids. Without telling them, she goes to this nuclear weapons factory with the Berrigan brothers and some others, and they do an action at this place as a protest against nuclear proliferation. And she risked a lifetime in jail. That's what they were threatening her with when she was arrested. To a great shock to her family. And ultimately, she was lucky because she only served 11 weeks in jail. But after that, she became a lifelong peace activist. She helped form the Thomas Merton Center in Pittsburgh 50 years ago, which is one of the oldest peace and justice organizations of its kind in America. Now, what happened is last spring in May, she simply reposted a meme on Facebook. It was, and the meme was a picture of Martin Luther King. Probably you've seen it, or maybe you've seen it. And it said, never rioted, never looted, change the world. And she immediately was mobbed on Facebook, you know, attacked as a racist. Her family, who tried to stand up for her on Facebook, was attacked as racist and white trash. And of course, as usual, in these cases, she publicly apologized on Facebook, but this was not enough. So ultimately, the Thomas Merton Center, which she helped to found 50 years ago, put out a letter that they posted on Facebook publicly, that they sent to all Thomas Merton Center members, saying that she had posted a racist meme. They didn't say what it was, and that because she won't properly apologize, they didn't even indicate she had ever apologized, but they said she would have to properly apologize. In the absence of that, they said, we can no longer work with Molly Rush, the person who founded this organization. She, of course, was devastated. She's 85 years old. She's in the autumn of her years. And to be canceled, and I think that's a great word in this case, by the organization she founded because of a meme that she, again, without thinking very much, just hit share on Facebook, is just an incredible thing that happened. That's what really led me to say, you know, somebody's just got to speak out about this, because my view is that most people don't buy this. They don't think this is good, but they're afraid if they say that, they're going to be canceled too.
Well, indeed, Dan Kovalik, you begin your book by talking about the importance of speaking freely, and you tell the story of Molly Rush, and then you go through in various areas where we've seen cancel culture, from Russiagate to a red baiting of Bernie Sanders and others. Again, I'm going to come back to academic freedom. And also, you and I imagine in this segment are going to talk a little bit more too about so-called performative wokeness. sort of as a virtue signaling construct, and how identity politics has really morphed in a lot of ways what activism is looking like now. And I would argue, often, unfortunately, minus historical context and particularly class analysis. And Dan, I was curious, because you bring this up in the book in various intersections. First, you just said it was important for somebody to stand up. It was important for somebody to say something without fear of reprisal. You're not alone, but here you are with, again, a very timely book. One, I think, of the first significant ones to come out with this angle, with your particular thesis about cancel culture and the progressive case against it. What's this importance of speaking freely? And how do we navigate these very difficult conversations where somebody like Molly Rush could be canceled after half a century of activism?
There's a number of reasons why I believe the ability to speak freely is important. For one, it allows us to discuss important ideas, to test our own ideas, to test other people's ideas without the fear of reprisal. You know, if someone says something that is incorrect, it's certainly fine for someone to say, well, I don't think that's correct for these reasons, and allow that person to say, well, I think it is for these other reasons. This can build understanding, mutual understanding, and can allow us to develop knowledge and wisdom on issues together, instead of just saying, I don't like what you said. I'm not even going to really tell you why it's offensive. It just is by definition, because I say it is. And I want to silence you. This does not help with intellectual development or finding out facts and truth. So that's one thing. And that's something a lot of academics talk about. You know, that's what people talked about when they signed that letter last year against cancel culture. You remember those intellectuals like Chomsky?
The Harper's Magazine letter that created a stir?
Yes. Yeah. And it was incredible. It created a stir because it was the most inoffensive defense of free speech I've ever seen. But it did. And it shows kind of where we're at. But the other reason it's important, or one other reason it's important to have a free expression of ideas, is specifically so we can, I believe, deal constructively with issues such as racism and sexism and transphobia. People need to say, hey, okay, you say this about racism or whatever, or about some racist incident. Well, I have questions about that. Did it happen the way you say it did, or for the reasons you say it did? And again, it's important that someone be able to ask that question. And that's because by asking questions, again, without being jumped on and getting rational responses, that person hopefully can be brought along to think in ways that we think are progressive, but also maybe their questions can teach us something. I mean, the idea that any of us have a monopoly on wisdom is just incredible. None of us do. I don't, you know, and I say a few times in my book, look, okay, I could be wrong about this. I don't know, you know, I don't know everything. But what I do know is I feel this way and I think this way and I explain why I think those ways. If you disagree with me, prove me wrong, which is great. And I'm willing to be proven wrong. But this idea that, oh, no, I'm not going to prove you wrong. I'm just going to get my buddies and we're going to harass you on social media. And we're even going to try to get you fired from your job. This is not a way to create a movement that is tolerant of people because of race, gender, or any other reason, right? It's by definition not tolerant. It's intolerant. It's an intolerant movement who would do this sort of thing. And it's not a movement, frankly, and I'll say it, I say it in the book and I'll say it now, that I want to be a part of. It's not something that moves me in a positive way.
Dan, I'm curious too, and you write about this. You've got a great quote on postmodern reengineering of left-wing political theory, in particular about privilege and intersectionality. It seems that postmodernism has sort of crept in to thought and language, a degree to which that intent has become moot. And the cancellation of different groups or individuals is often rebranded in gaslighting fashion as it's not about gotcha and calling out, it's about calling in. But one can't help but notice the finger-wagging, admonishing tendency of the so-called calling in process. I mean, I've seen it myself in Northern California in activist circles and some significant changes in activist culture just in the last 5 years, in the last two in particular. It's been quite riveting to notice how essentialist and reductionist some of the attention to social justice matters has become. And like you note as well, it becomes increasingly difficult to engage in thoughtful, respectful dialogue about these matters in order to expand the ideas and understanding to incorporate even more disparate voices, especially including those who either don't understand some of the historical context of the issues, but also who flatly already disagree. So if the purpose of activism, if the purpose of this kind of social justice work is to change the world or to make it a better place, we have to then work to sway or change the minds of others with whom we disagree. And so how do we do that if we are dividing ourselves into camps and not directly engaging and listening, not just critically thinking, but critically listening to those who have different experiences, different backgrounds? Again, getting into the lived experience argument, I'm not discounting that in any way, but I'm suggesting that given that we all have different ones, how then do we mitigate those differences in the regular course of our dialogues in a way that is constructive, in a way that does work toward building a more just and inclusive society?
You raise a lot of issues there, and I guess I'll start with the first one you raise, and that is this idea that somehow intention doesn't matter. Of course, intention does matter. By the way, in this letter that I cited from the Thomas Merton Center canceling Molly Rush, they say in there, intention doesn't matter. Okay, so this is almost a truism or a slogan of this cancer culture. What that means is that the white supremacist, the avowed white supremacist who puts on a sheet at night, a Ku Klux Klanman, is no worse than the well-intentioned liberal or whatever who says something wrong, because intention doesn't matter. If you're racist, you're racist. We're going to lump them into the same grouping. Again, someone who is well-intentioned, who may even consider themselves your comrade and your colleague and your friend, because they say something inadvertently offensive or something we construe to be offensive, again, we're going to treat you the same as we would this guy over here who's an avowed white supremacist. You're all racist. What this does, of course, is cut off potential comrades, potential friends, potential allies in the fight for social justice. But in fact, this really seems, if people were honest about it, to be the intent. In fact, someone recently gave me a term for this that I think is pretty interesting. It's a Freudian term, apparently, called the narcissism of small differences. And it's this idea that in a society, when you have different groups that frankly actually don't really significantly differ from each other, those small differences are focused on in order for the members of this particular group or tribe to feel superior to those others and to be able to differentiate themselves from those others. And that's what you see here, that you can have someone who agrees with you on 99% of your political views. And then there's 1% that either they don't agree with you on, or they simply don't understand it, or don't even know it's an issue. And you're going to distinguish yourself from that person by saying, okay, well, you're no good. I know. Yeah, 99% you're good, but the 1% is going to make you bad, and we're going to shove you aside. Again, this doesn't build a movement. And by the way, it is completely insane because all of us are imperfect. We all make mistakes. The idea that anyone out there has the right to say, well, that mistake makes you a bad person, is just, to me, incredible.
Dan Kovalik, I can't help but think of the relentless litmus testing and stridency of the circular firing squad that is the left. It's riveting to see it rise again and again in cycles over the years. I'd like to remind our listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We are speaking to labor rights attorney and author Dan Kovalik. His newest book is Cancel. This book, The Progressive Case Against Cancel Culture. We'll continue our conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us.
Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right, if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we are discussing a new book out in April. It's from Hot Books and Skyhorse. It's called Cancel This Book, The Progressive Case Against Cancel Culture. We are joined by author Dan Kovalik. He is the author of numerous books in the very recent past, which include The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, The Plot to Attack Iran, The Plot to Control the World, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, and No More War. Dan, before the break, you were going through some of the various arguments, thoughts behind your current publication. And speaking of some of the titles of your previous books, I know that you have been one of the folks that has been relentlessly calling out in many ways the red baiting, the Russia gating that we've seen for years now. In fact, this goes back some ways, although it's been turned into a cottage industry by the Democratic Party, particularly the establishment media, especially the corporate liberal press, MSNBC, Rachel Maddow, or MSDNC, as some call it occasionally. We've written about this ourselves at Project Censored, but we've also been targeted because of the fact that we talk about how these are old tactics to smear people to avoid discussion and debate about real challenges that we face that are not somewhere over there or abroad in Russia. So, Dan, could you talk to us about that issue in particular? Because you do dedicate some time in the book to it.
I do think that the current cancel culture does find its origins in things like the McCarthy period, in which people received similar treatment, shaming, loss of jobs, because they were accused of being communists. Whether that was true or not, many times they were simply people who supported the New Deal, or they were unionists or civil rights people, whatever. But everyone at that point was a communist, right? And so that was a way to, frankly, destroy that period of progressivism in America, and it worked quite well. I believe that cancel culture, while it claims to be woke, claims to be fighting racism, and claims to be building social justice, works in the same way of McCarthyism. It's just a different way to attack people. So now there's not many communists left, not that that prevents people from trying to engage in communist witch hunts once in a while, but they use something now that is even more damaging and hurtful to you, to a progressive, by the way. It really won't work on a right-wing person. And that is to call you a racist, right? Or a sexist, because we don't want to be racist, right? We don't want to be sexist. So calling you that is a way to isolate you and to silence you. And again, in the name of social justice, when in fact, I think many times it's undermining social justice. And a good example of this, you know, I gave the example of Molly Rush, but I give one of Adolph Reed, who's African-American, longtime civil rights activist, a Marxist, and he's been effectively canceled. Why? Because he has tried to say that, yeah, race is important. There is racism that we have to struggle against, but also don't forget about class. The class issue in America is still important. The idea of the 99% versus the 1% is still important. And I like that phrasing of it, 99% versus the 1%, because guess what? That's a huge tent.
And from Occupy, coming up on the 10th anniversary this year, very important addition to the lexicon politically.
Because what that does is say all of us, except for the Bezoses of the world, and the Mark Zuckerbergs and the Elon Musks, aside for those few multi-billionaires, we all have a common interest to fight for. And we need to unite, because 99% of the population cannot be defeated by 1%. But with this new movement, a huge portion of that 99% is being written off as deplorable. Almost 75 million people voted for Donald Trump. You cannot write off all 75 million people. If you do that, you do that to your peril. as someone who cares about social justice. If you do that, we will never win. And by the way, those 75 million people, of those, 18 million were people of color. A lot of people of color voted for Trump. A lot were women. A lot were people who support things that we support, like Medicare for all, like police reform, like criminal justice reform. I mean, the incredible thing about what happened last summer with the protests is that you saw people who we consider deplorables on the left from places like Hazard, Kentucky, in Omaha, Nebraska, and northern Minnesota, and Alabama protesting for Black lives. These were the deplorables. And yet, they joined the cause. They were moved by that cause. What that shows is those people are reachable. But many times those people are written off. And I find that amazingly troubling.
You talk about this in a couple chapters in the book. You have one chapter that's called We're All Snitches Now. You get into some of these contradictions and some of these things. And you also talk later about what's happening in higher education. You're in higher education. And of course, we see this all the time. We see how this is permeating almost everything institutionally, this corporate model of top-down training. You simply take a workshop and voila, centuries of racism is somehow going to be disappeared. Not suggesting that we don't need to address these kinds of issues, but intersectional analysis is something that's well over 30 years old and has roots dating back even before that in academic culture and activist culture. And again, it seems, in your estimation, I'm curious, where has some of that intersectional analysis go? The recent horrible tragedy in Atlanta and Boulder, for example, got very disparate kinds of attention based on specifics. And there is an uptick in anti-Asian violence in the United States. And there's a long history of this. And you rightly connect it to imperialism and foreign policy and xenophobia in another chapter of this book. But where I'm going with this is that the intersectional analysis of something like happened in Atlanta, where many of the victims were Asian, more of the victims were women. There wasn't much of a narrative about misogyny and patriarchy and violence against women. And the murderer in this case was talking about their issues with the church and religion and all of the other challenges they faced. In other words, there are so many factors that have contributed to this completely heinous behavior that it gets distilled to one element or reason, seems to miss, at least in part, miss the bigger mark that we could be building around. What are your thoughts about that, Dan?
There's a lot to unpack there, but I mean, to start with that question, you're right. The other thing about that shooter in Atlanta is he was planning to go and kill porn stars. And most of those were going to be white people, by the way, white porn stars. So as you say, the question of misogyny and sexism, I think, largely took a back seat in this story. Why that is, I can't totally account for, though I do think that misogyny is a very strong force in American society and culture. And I do think that the present day left has largely ignored that, if not contributed to that in its own way. The idea of feminism does not have the cachet it once had amongst particularly younger leftists. So that's at least my sense. And I think part of that is because of this idea of gender identity, which is considered so fluid that the question of who is a woman and what a woman is now up for grabs. And again, now I'm going to be canceled for saying that. But we have to face this, that this is an issue.
An issue that needs to be openly discussed.
Exactly. Because again, the idea that there are girls and women in the world is now being greatly challenged. I saw a commercial the other day. It was for some drug, and it said that this drug is dangerous to certain people, including people identified as female at birth. Well, we have a name for those people. They're called girls. When they grow up, they're women. I mean, why can't we use those terms? When you start to disappear those ideas, then in some ways you're disappearing those people. And again, we have to confront this. I think we can do that and still be respectful of transgender people, but we have to find a way to do that without, again, erasing the idea of females.
There's a lot of this attacking the messenger that seems to be going on in these kinds of cultures, too. There are people that on the receiving end of a cancellation for merely suggesting what you just suggested, even if you didn't put forward a particular position, the fact that you're trying to pretend that you can have a dialogue where there's disagreement is in and of itself a new offense.
Yeah, just asking questions, asking the wrong questions. And as I talk about in the book, you know, that is a part of religiosity, and there is a religiosity to all this. You know, I was raised Catholic, and I was deeply immersed in Catholicism for many years, and so I understand this. And one of the things about religion, as I know from Catholicism, is that you must believe without seeing, and you must believe what you're told and not ask questions about it. The idea of a Holy Trinity, three persons and one God, who can get their head around that? But you can't ask about it. It just is. And there is a religiosity to this. It's not just that you're not allowed to have a different view. You can't even question.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time. We didn't get to a few elements of your book that I found to be very important, including foreign policy, including about Palestine. I'm glad to see you included the story of journalist Abby Martin, who was canceled in Georgia at a critical media literacy conference that we were involved in at Project Censored and covered that this past year. I definitely want to have you back on to talk more about this and have a few other folks on to do it. Again, very timely book, Cancel This Book. How do you hope people might utilize this book? What do you hope that this book may generate? I mean, again, we've both quipped or joked at least a couple of times about you're going to be canceled. But these are very serious issues, and I think that you're making a very honest, sincere, intellectual effort to further discourse and understanding. And again, it dovetails with a book project I'm doing right now with Nolan Higdon called Let's Agree to Disagree. So final thoughts here that you want people to take away about this really significant book that you have coming out very soon from Hot Books.
The main message I have is that, look, if you want to be a true social activist, you have to approach that position with humility, with compassion. And that means confronting people who are well-intentioned, but with whom you disagree, with understanding and forgiveness, and not deciding to shoot first, so to speak, and ask questions later. We need to be able to ask questions. We need to talk to each other. We need to broaden the tent of people in the movement, not make it smaller by canceling people for small gradations of difference.
Dan Kovalik, it's an honor to have you back on the program. You are a labor and human rights lawyer, author of numerous books. Your latest book that we were discussing today is Cancel This Book, The Progressive Case Against Cancel Culture. You have accolades from the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges, filmmaker Oliver Stone, and also Alan Dershowitz. Some interesting praise here. And of course, I'd be remiss to not mention great thanks to Lorna Garano for reconnecting us once again on your new book, Dan. Certainly wish you all the best. And I really hope that this publication spurs much needed discussion and dialogue about this important matter.
Thank you, Mickey.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself along with Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer, Mickey Huff, of this program. Also the host, Anthony Fest, our senior producer. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics of the apocalypse, got the skies like an ominous.